Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Mike Hinchey, globally renowned researcher and IFIP incoming president. Mike, thank you for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Thank you, Stephen. Good to be with you.
Now, Mike, congratulations on your nomination as president of IFIP, and I have a series of questions, like can you describe IFIP and the value of IFIP to government, academia, and business, and some of the key projects for IFIP during your presidency and how you'll measure success.
Sure. Well, IFIP was founded under the auspices of UNESCO back in 1960, and essentially it is a society of societies in that each member country has a member society in the field of ICT, so they are computer societies or engineering societies primarily. And IFIP brings them together in a single forum. Now, many of these are obviously giving inputs to their own governments about what they would like to see in the ICT field and how they would like to see government focus their efforts and funding and so on and so forth. And IFIP gives an opportunity to bring that all together globally. So we have members all around the world. At the moment, we have over 50 members, and thanks to new membership rules that we've brought in, we hope to expand that further and to bring in other countries and other regions that we don't currently represent. And all of these, of course, then go back to their own governments and give input to that government. So ICEP puts together policy on a global scale, and then the individual members have their feedback on their national scale. And what we do is both technical in the sense of we have 13 technical committees that cover all sorts of areas of ICT, and together we do work, publications, journals, conferences, meetings, working groups, etc., that contribute to technical advancement. But then the members of the General Assembly, which would be one per country, contribute to policy making and so on. We have a number of initiatives at the moment that are very important. One that you yourself know about is the professionalism. We also have contributions in education. We contribute technically, and we are particularly looking at areas like security, privacy, disaster recovery, and so on. So these all have global implications.
And then, I guess, what are some key projects for your IFIP during your presidency, and how will you measure success?
Well, the key things that I'm interested in, being an academic, of course, I'm interested in education, and I'm particularly interested in seeing how we can bring more women into ICT, and so that will be very much a focus for us. Professionalism is, of course, a major contributor from IFIP, because we do want to see that we are professionals in this field. Many other areas are much more regulated, for example, medicine, and so therefore ensuring that we advance that is going to be important. How are we going to measure success? I guess is seeing that these things actually do take place. It would be nice if we could get governments to endorse the idea of professionalism and how we might accredit that. It would be great to see a much greater uptake of female participation in ICT. I myself have been working at the level of schools in Ireland, and we're looking now at how we might make that much more global. So I guess there are things that are going to be hard to measure in the very short term, but I do think we'll be able to see some sort of uptake. And if we can see a greater participation in ICT by women and greater professionalism, I think that will be a great thing.
So can you describe your tenure?
Well, I will be president for 3 years, starting at the end of the General Assembly, which will be in September in Costa Rica. There is a possibility of a second term, but who knows what will happen in that. My involvement will mean going to meet a lot of the computer societies who are members of IFIP and engaging with them. But one of the big things that I'll be planning to do is to try and increase our membership, as I said, particularly in places where we're not currently represented, and our new rules and regulations for membership will make that possible. So there'll be a lot of getting involved with other people who are not currently in IFIP and trying to get them to join in with us.
So just as a bit of value to the audience, I'll just mention that this interview appears with many IFIP member societies, and some of the members aren't aware of the sort of this broader organization. So one example would be the Canadian Information Processing Society, which is a member of IFIP. In fact, a founding member of IFIP, the ACM, this interview will appear with them as well. and again, another founding member of IFIT, but representing the U.S. and so on. So it's just sort of the benefit of the audience, giving them a broader kind of scope. Now, Mike, you have this amazing sort of profile and background and resume. And I'm really curious about your journey of enlightenment from an early age to, let's say, your late teens and some of the milestones.
Okay. Well, I think I had a pretty ordinary, normal background growing up. I grew up in a small country in a time when the country was not very, very wealthy. We improved a lot over the years. So I guess I lived in a very small town. The third largest city in the country was only 40,000 people when I was growing up, so it was pretty small. I did have one advantage, that my father was a computer engineer, and he ran the systems for air traffic control at Shannon Airport. And regularly he would have to work on bank holidays, just that somebody had to be there, and he would take me with him. And I got to know the people he worked with, and I got to use computers. So I guess I was using a computer as a six-year-old, where most people my age at that time didn't even know what a computer was. So that was a big advantage. But I guess sort of wanting to go into computing itself was something that I tossed and turned about for quite a while. It came down to a decision of, I was either going to do computer science in university or I was going to do French. And I decided to do computer science. And I guess how I got into my own particular field was an interesting one, in that I was rummaging through the library, as you used to do back in those days, with physical books, actual real books. And I picked up a book called The Correctness Problem in Computer Science. And there was a three-page first paper in it. I think it was three pages. It might have been five, but a very short paper by Edsger Dijkstra, Why Correctness Must Be a Mathematical Concern. And I read it, and I felt really convinced by it that this was the area I should be going into. And then, from having been someone who really didn't like mathematics in high school, got into the field and understood why mathematics was so important in computing. And I guess that was the epiphany, if you like.
And then going on from there, how did your life change further in universities, and while you were at university, I should say, what were some of the milestones and powerful lessons that you learned and that continue to shape your vision into the future?
Well, I went to university at my local university, where I'm now professor of software engineering. And it happened to have a very good reputation in computer science, and still does. And I decided to go there. But having gotten into the area of mathematical correctness of software, which, as I say, I had gotten into by the time I was in, I guess, my second or third year of university. And then I started to look around for master's programs, and found that the best one in my field was a master's in computation at Oxford. And Tony Hoare, who of course was one of the luminaries in computer science and still is, was the head of department there and running it. And I was very lucky enough to have him co-supervise my thesis. And I guess that was one of the big milestones, was taking on this topic in a world-class university with a world-class supervisor, and somebody who obviously knew the field so well and opened many doors for me in that sense. And I think that was probably the biggest game changer in my career.
You know, you go on from there, and you've made so many different contributions in so many different areas. Let's drill into them a little further. For example, you support formal methods. What's the value to enterprises?
Well, I mean, the idea is that software underpins just about absolutely everything we do. We had an open day here in my center recently, and I said to people, you know, how many millions of lines of code have you used already today, and it's only 11 o'clock in the morning? So software is used in just about every enterprise, and I think the fact that that software is correct is so vital in so many fields. And it's correctness, people often worry about safety critical systems, and of course that's part of it, and that's where formal methods are primarily used. But there are so many more non-safety critical systems that really do have to work, and that an enterprise can lose so much by a short amount of downtime. We had an incident in Ireland 3 or 4 years ago. One of the banks was unable to make payments for a few days, and it cost billions because so many people were just affected by it. So, you know, the fact that software really does work correctly is vital, even in things that we don't consider to be safety critical. So to me, software and formal methods for developing software has so much to give to any sort of enterprise.
Now, you're a past director at the NASA Software Engineering Laboratory. Can you talk about some of that work and the opportunities and key challenges and lessons you watched?
It goes to the same sort of thing. I mean, that obviously, you can imagine, NASA uses a lot of software that is absolutely critical, and in particular if you go into manned missions where human life is at stake. But even if you take something as simple as a satellite, I mean, that has to work. The amount of effort that goes into building it, the amount of the cost, the human effort, the lead time in developing it. If it fails, then it's an absolute disaster. But I mean, you know, many people think that, you know, NASA, you go in and you have all these amazing things to work with, and you have all these supercomputers and robots and things. And yes, there is that, but on a day-to-day basis, it's pretty much like any other job. It's normal. And you know, it wasn't all exciting, but a lot of it was a lot of fun, and it was a great time in my life.
You're also a founding editor-in-chief of their journal. Can you talk about that, and again, some lessons from that experience?
Sure. Well, actually, starting that journal was a huge task. It doesn't sound like a big thing to found a journal, but to found a journal with the NASA name on it, which NASA subsequently found to be a great asset, required 2 acts of Congress, which was phenomenal. And at various points, we felt like giving up. It was just too much hard work. But we did feel it was something worth doing, and I think it has been a great benefit to NASA and has really improved the quality of systems and software engineering within NASA by giving NASA researchers the opportunity to understand what's going on around the world by all sorts of people, because the people who publish it are not just NASA people, and the people who read it are not just NASA people. But it was a big asset to improving the quality of what people were doing within NASA.
Do you still maintain ties with NASA?
Yes, I had a position with them until quite recently as an expert, was the official job title, and I love to tell people at conferences that I'm the only expert in the U.S. federal government, which is technically true. But yes, I still have a lot of engagement with NASA. We don't have formal ties right now, but I'm still working with them. A number of my patent applications that were filed while I worked with NASA are still going through the process, so we are still pursuing some of those. So I get to talk with NASA people on a regular basis.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of fascinating. Can you describe your past academic journey and lessons for each position?
Do you mean to include my time at university or just my professional career?
Your professional career.
Professional career. Well, I started, I had finished my PhD, and I had been lucky enough to get a green card in the U.S. visa lottery. And a colleague asked me to join him at a department in New Jersey Institute of Technology. He was trying to build up their real-time computing lab and felt that my formal methods background would be very appropriate for that. So I went there, and we worked in building up this lab. And then the department chair moved to University of Nebraska, and he had them offer me an endowed chair. So it seemed like a good offer to go. And again, they were building up a department, and they did so very successfully, and it was really, really interesting. And then by luck, I suppose, I found myself with this NASA opportunity, in that NASA were given the opportunity to hire 12 people from outside the civil service and to be hired in at the top level of the civil service, which is very unusual. And I met with the administrator a couple of times, and I felt that it looked like they were going to make me an offer to be one of these 12 people. And then they announced the first person was hired, and he had a Nobel Prize for discovering and curing hepatitis C, which I thought was absolutely phenomenal. And I thought, well, there's no way they're going to hire me. And about a week later, they came along and offered me the position, which was fantastic. But it was actually a fixed term, and they extended it a number of times. And then eventually it couldn't be extended anymore, and that's why I moved on. But fortuitously, there was a great opportunity to become, at the time, co-director of this research center in Ireland, which at the time was fairly small, being about 50 people, but spread across four universities. And the opportunity came for me to take up that position, which I did for a number of reasons, partly because for family reasons, to come home. And we've since grown that from, as I said, about 50 people in four universities to 225 people in eight universities.
You know, it's fascinating how your career has evolved. And I just want to step back for a moment. Earlier you mentioned that you have patents pending. Can you get into more detail about that and what you hope to achieve from those patents? And are you planning to be, like work in startups and entrepreneurship?
Well, I hadn't actually really gotten to the point of trying to do startups, but the patents are in two main areas. One is in the automatic code generation and a new technique for generating code that is provably correct and really builds on my formal methods background. And some of those patents have been licensed to a tool vendor who will include this in their next generation of automatic code generating tools. Unfortunately, the contract requires that I don't say who the company are, but they're a very major tool vendor. And then the other area is in autonomous systems, and so primarily based around swarm-based missions, and so essentially what we nowadays call drones, but these would be to fly in space and in particular around the asteroid belt. So those are being used by NASA in forthcoming missions, but some of the technology could be used in other applications, and we have a couple of companies who are interested in licensing those, and I would be involved with helping them to get the technology into reality. We haven't actually really given a lot of consideration to startups because in tool vendors, it's a very tricky thing to do. In the autonomous systems, we're still really working on it, and we still see so much potential for it to be used in NASA missions that, who knows, it might be startups in the future, but we haven't really looked at it right now.
Now, you talk about your position as director of this Irish Software Engineering Research Center and how it's expanded considerably. Can you detail some notable results from this work?
Well, we've done a lot of work with a lot of companies. Ireland is a small country. It's only about 4 million people. So to be 225 in our research group is quite substantial. So we've worked with probably close to 200 companies. So, for example, we've helped a company that does floodplain mapping to port their software to IBM's BlueJeans so that they can do much better mapping and much more fine-grained mapping. And, of course, it gives IBM an opportunity to show how valuable the BlueJeans technology is. We've worked with a number of city councils on how we might automate traffic routing, in particular when there's problems and like flooding or road work or that kind of thing. We've worked with a company that people would not know the name of, but they manufactured the chips that are used in virtually every cell phone. So we've been working with them on how we can make traffic monitoring cameras more efficient and to port software to run on multi-core so that instead of centralizing all the analysis can be done in the individual camera. We've worked with one of the things we did do actually, and it did generate a startup, is that we worked with IBM on how we might be able to automate dealing with issues raised in data centers. So as logs were raised and problems were seen, we were able to automate how we could respond to those, or at least a huge proportion of those. And that became a spin-out over the last few years, and it was sold recently for $68 million.
You know, you have this great opportunity in that you're sort of the intersection of so much happening in industry and academia, and also in the broader communities as this incoming president of IFIP. As a result, you have access to a lot of information. So from your perspective, what do you see as the top resources? You know, there's so much noise out there. So from your perspective, what are the top resources and lessons that you can share with the audience?
Tricky question. It's hard to compartmentalize things, really. It's a great opportunity, as you say, to be able to intersect with so many different areas. So it's been great to work with companies, especially here in Ireland. We have a lot of access to multinationals because although they have smaller operations in Ireland than they might have, for example, in the U.S., it means that we can get to talk to the individuals, we can get talk to the managers, we can talk to the workers. That's a great opportunity for us. It's been fabulous being in IFIP and meeting, you know, very distinguished people from all over the world who are high-ranking in their own member societies and in their own countries, and then we get to meet them on a regular basis and to engage with them. And we're very lucky also in Ireland, being a small country, that we have great access to our government, and it's quite common to meet our ministers, and it's quite common to be invited to go to the parliament and to talk with senior figures and senior civil servants. So, you know, we really have a great opportunity in that sense, and that's one of the big advantages of being in a small country.
Now, is it possible to be sort of specific in terms of the kind of the journals or the digital libraries or communities that you belong to? So IFIP obviously would be one that you would recommend as a great resource for the broader audience to look
Absolutely.
At IFIP News and their digital library and so on. But are there others that you can sort of specify?
Well, I mean, I'm a member of IEEE and have been since I was a student. I'm actually the vice chair of IEEE UK and Ireland, only since the 1st of January, so I'm quite new to that role and still understanding all the things that are going on. I've done a lot of volunteering for IFIP in the past, but it's been in the US, so sort of getting to know new people and new personalities over here in Ireland and the UK, and that's a great opportunity. I'm a member of the Irish Computer Society, of which I'm vice president, and that's actually the national member for IFIP. And I'm also a member of Engineers Ireland, which is, as it sounds, an engineering body. And I'm a fellow of the British Computer Society and the Institute of Engineering Technology in the UK. And I actually do work for the Brazilian Computer Society. I'm the editor-in-chief of their journal, which is published open access.
Well, quite a few different roles.
Yeah.
As a result of all these different roles that you play, then you're at the epicenter in terms of where things are going to the future. So can you describe some mega trends and how they will shape our world and our destiny?
Well, we all saw cloud as being a mega trend, and cloud is here to stay. But I think the prevalence of all the social media and the cloud and putting things into the cloud has raised the issue of security and privacy, and I think that's going to be a mega issue for the future. We've kind of come to the stage of being, you know, in a world of what people are calling cyber-physical social systems. So cyber obviously is the computing aspect, but is interacting with the physical world, and then we're interacting with society, and there's, as you've seen, I'm sure, and the listeners have seen and read, many issues of people putting information out on the internet and then it coming back to haunt them in later life. It's become a big thing. So I think the fact that we are dealing with the physical world and society and the interaction of that is going to be major. But one of the mega trends within that is going to be this issue of security and privacy and being able to withdraw things that you don't necessarily want out there in the future, and letting people know that they have to be careful about what they make available about themselves online.
It'd be interesting to get your views. You know, there's this sort of controversy about biological evolution versus silicon evolution. So you have all of these, you know, five main schools of machine learning and all the progression that's being made, you know, to almost daily announcements. And even at the IFIP General Assembly, coming together to make a news, you know, take a stand on autonomous weapons and things like that. But then on the other side, you have this thing called CRISPR-Cas9 or CPF1, you know, these gene editing techniques and what's going to happened in terms of biological evolution. Do you see some sort of threats on both sides, or some sort of convergence, or even maybe the human species being overtaken?
I would like to hope that the human species won't be overtaken. Probably a certain degree of convergence is likely to happen. That would be my expectation. I may be completely wrong, but that's what I would assume. There's been a lot of talk about, you know, building something that's truly intelligent, but, you know, do we even know what intelligence is? And who knows if we'll build something that we might regret in the future, but I see some sort of convergence between the two, and it would be good if we could make use of some of these techniques to, for example, not necessarily cure, but counteract things like dementia and Alzheimer's, and if we could build something that's really useful to society. But I think, you know, where we actually will get to is hard to estimate. I know there are people who think that we can eventually download our entire memories into a machine and thereby live forever, but whether that's actually going to be possible or practical is a different matter.
Yeah, it's interesting. I just read a piece, I think it was out of MIT, where the estimation is that our memory capacity is 10 times greater than they previously thought, and it just came about recently, so it'll be interesting to try to download that. Anyways,
well, then we have to make the machines 10 times bigger and 10 times more powerful, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, you mentioned some predictions. How can ICT executives act on your predictions or your sort of feelings about megatrends?
I mean, it's a matter of devoting resources. I think that's where ICT executives can contribute and in funding the right kind of work. Unfortunately, you know, especially in academia, we're all chasing funding, and funding is getting less, but funding is also getting more focused, and as long as we focus on the right things. So I guess executives can determine and prioritize their funding or their resources or use of resources on areas that will develop for everyone.
You know, you're involved in so many different areas, quite remarkable, you're very eclectic in all the things that you do, and such a renowned background in all of the different domains that you've entered. So what things continue to excite you?
Well, I mean, lots of things excite me, I guess. I really do enjoy my job, and it's rarely the same 2 days in a row. I have lucky enough to be able to work and talk with really, really interesting people. I get to work on some really interesting projects, particularly doing things with NASA, and exploiting technology that, you know, really is at the forefront and really is ahead of its time. And I get to travel to great places to meet some really outstanding people. So, but my own work, like everyone, I have days that are boring and uneventful, but there are a lot of things that are really great in what I do and what I get to do. And that gives me great excitement. And I really am enjoying working on space exploration missions. I'm continuing that work. We're doing work also for the European Space Agency as well as with NASA. And it's fascinating and it is really exciting. And I mean, I don't know a huge amount about astrophysics, but I'm learning and finding new things every day and getting know new things every day and getting an understanding of how the universe works, and that is all very exciting.
Mike, you have so many different roles. Where do you find the time?
Well, you know, it's good that there's 28 hours in the day.
That's interesting.
Yes.
Now, you're an amazing executive in that you've led so many different projects and organizations, and that work is even continuing. So what makes a great executive?
I don't know. I mean, I don't consider myself a great executive. I just consider myself to be somebody who enjoys what he does, and maybe that's part of it, that to be successful in your career or in your role at work is important that you enjoy what you do. And I'm fortunate that I did pick the right topic. As I mentioned, it was a toss-up whether I would do computer science or French at the university. Had I done French, who knows what I'd be doing now. I'm sure my life would be very different. It might be even more exciting. It might be boring. I don't know. But I think to be successful, you have to do what you want to do, and that's important. And like I said, you know, everybody has boring days at work, and everyone has days that are just monotonous meetings, but as long as there's a sufficient amount of time that you get them to do something you really, really are enjoying, then I think that's really important.
You know, Mike, it's clear in the discussions we've had so far, you're sort of at the forefront of innovation and through all the different communities that you're involved with, and all the research projects that are you're leading, and all the, you know, the patent work, and working in with governments and industry. It's just an amazing, which means that agility is key today, and whether it's a startup or launching a new product or service within a larger enterprise. And you'd be very familiar with this idea of a startup mentality. So what do you see as the key steps for successful startups and when producing innovations to be competitive?
Well, I don't consider myself to be an expert in this, and I probably shouldn't tell you this, and I probably shouldn't publicize it, but a friend of mine came to me a number of years ago and said he had this great idea for a startup and would I like to get involved, and I didn't like the idea. I thought it was not going to go anywhere, and it became LinkedIn. So maybe I'm not the best person in terms of having passed up a great opportunity like that. But that said, I think, you know, it is having the right idea and having the passion to sell that right idea, even if people tell you it isn't a right idea. And I think that is the key to a successful startup, is complete commitment to the idea, and whatever happens, no matter how many people tell you you're wasting your time, to persevere. And I think that's hard to do, but if you really are committed to that vision, to that product, to that idea, then that is what will make it work.
Mike, you are the epitome of innovation in so many different ways. And so what do you see as some of the key attributes in individuals and teams that produce winning products and services?
Well, like I said, I think it's an absolute passion for whatever that product or service is, and I think without that commitment, it's not going to work. I think being able to get on with people is absolutely essential. And unfortunately, a lot of people with great ideas don't have great people skills. And so maybe you need to bring in the right people for that. And it really is important to have a commitment and to have the right mixture of people and the right mixture of skills. And so I don't consider myself to be the best manager by any manner or means, but I have people who work with me who really do make up for the skills that I don't have. And so I think, again, it's having a winning team.
Now, you've already talked about this somewhat in your introduction in terms of the different things that IFIP is doing, but I'd like to get you to maybe speak about this further. You know, do you feel computing should be a recognized profession on par with some of the other ones that are out there, like accounting and law, with demonstrated professional development, adherence to the code of ethics, personal responsibility, public accountability, quality assurance, or recognized credentials?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there are so many areas where, you know, some software engineer, coder, whatever title you want to give them, has the opportunity to be a great innovator and contribute a lot, but also has the possibility of really, really destroying everything. I don't know if you remember the old joke, anyone can make a mistake, but to really foul things up, you need a computer. And it's true, because we're reliant on computers and software in just about everything we do, and one little mistake can make such a difference. And people need to be accountable, both that they have applied the best approach possible, and that they have done due diligence and they have really produced the right thing that was required. And we wouldn't take lack of professionalism from people doing work around our house, so why should we take it from people who are writing the software that runs our ATMs or our cars or our GPS systems or our entertainment systems even? So I do think that it is absolutely essential that computing is recognized, and I do think having some sort of certification or accreditation would be a great thing. And maybe not everybody needs to do that, but I think in certain fields where people are writing truly critical software, they should be accountable and there should be some way of ensuring that they are well-trained, up-to-date, and using the best possible techniques.
You know, it's interesting. I had a discussion with Matthias Obrecht, the CIO of Audi, and he was indicating, you know, support for professionalism, or Roy Taylor is quite a luminary, indicating support, or so many others. Tadeo Sato, when he was on the board of Toyota as their CTO, again, providing support. And it very much aligns with what you've indicated in terms of professionalism. How about on the ethical side? What are some of your recommendations in that area, especially with, you know, what happened with Dieselgate and so on?
I think, you know, that as I say, you know, accountability is essential, and that people have to be accountable for what they do. People do make mistakes, and we have to understand this. But if we can demonstrate that we're doing best we can, and we're doing the right things, and we're using the best techniques that we have, then that accountability is met, and that professionalism is essential.
Yeah, I just as you were talking about the ethical components, it just reminded me that in a discussion with Vince Cerf as well, he is starting coming out and saying maybe this is something we need to look at, this whole idea of credentials and accountability. So it's interesting how it's proliferating. Now, what other areas related to computing do you feel need to be brought into focus for discussion and policy?
I think, you know, the ethics and professionalism need to be high up on the list. I think, you know, appropriate security and privacy measures need to be brought into the forum, and ensuring that people have training in the right areas and understand, for example, the legalities of the area that they work in. And not everybody needs to be a lawyer or an expert in law, but people should at least know the things that pertain to themselves and how they may be stepping outside the box in applying the law.
Mike, you're world-renowned, and you worked for some of the most prestigious organizations in the world. Your academic background also aligns with that sort of model as well. You just so many different accomplishments. So maybe this is a really difficult question, but what are some of the impossible challenges you were able to master?
Oh, well, if I was able to master it, it couldn't really have been impossible. I've had difficulties. As I said, my job is very varied. I'm an academic, but I also manage a center, so I have to deal with people. I have to deal with issues, personal issues of people, problems with people not performing as they need to, and then I also deal with students. So I deal with a variety of different aspects. I've had some issues that have been very problematic. I've had funding cut and therefore had to let people go. There have been lots of issues that probably seemed major at the time, but they all were dealt with somehow. It's maybe not always necessarily exactly the way we would have preferred, but at least we managed to do it. So I don't think there's been anything that huge that we couldn't cope. Maybe the results were not the best we absolutely wanted, but we got there.
It sounds maybe some of the lessons that you can summarize from the last question is that you stay determined and you persevere. And as
yes.
You mentioned, all of the collaboration and teamwork aspects are important too. And the human relations aspects are important.
Well, that's it. That's a huge part of it. When you are in a team, and I say, you know, we have a team now that we've grown dramatically, you have to work well together and you have to interface well together. And, one faulty cog in that system can destroy the whole thing. And, you know, we all have colleagues who are difficult. We all have colleagues who don't necessarily pull their full weight all the time. But, you know, if we have colleagues that whom we can get along with and we have a single vision of where we want to get to, then I think the endeavor will succeed.
You know, it's clear that you're sort of the modern individual with so many different kinds of interests. Can you talk about ones that we haven't discussed so far? You know, other interests that maybe be surprising to the audience?
That's a tricky one. My hobbies tend to be things that I can do on the move because I travel a lot. So I love to read and I collect first edition books, which I guess is not anything terribly surprising. I'm a pretty ordinary, everyday type person.
An ordinary, everyday type person that's the president of a prestigious organization founded by UNESCO back in 1960 and has worked with NASA, has built one of the top research communities in the world, has an academic background, which is, again, amongst the most prestigious universities in the world, interfaces with government and industry at the highest levels. That's pretty amazing.
I guess I talk well.
Okay, well, we're going to start broadening this a little bit. We're down to our last few questions here. You choose the topic area. What do you see as some of the top broader challenges facing us today? And do you have any proposals of how they can be solved?
I don't know that I have any proposals of how they can be solved. Obviously, the world has a lot of problems right now. It's certainly not the best of times to be around. But, hopefully we will resolve that in some way. I don't think that anyone has a magic wand that they can wave and get rid of all the problems we have at the moment. But I think if we all persevere in our individual goals and try to advance society as best we can, then I think things will come around well in the end.
Mike, you do a lot of speaking and traveling, and you've mm-hmm. talked about this in this interview so far. You must have come across some really peculiar or interesting, amusing, unexpected, amazing stories, and maybe you can share a few of them.
Oof, that's a very tough one. I might have to come back to you on that one. I've had some interesting experiences, and particularly around travel, and it's been, some funny things have happened, and some bad things have happened, and some awful things have happened. But I've been very lucky to meet a lot of interesting people, and some of whom are quite famous, and others who are less so, but equally interesting people.
Well, that's...
I'm racking my brain for a story that I can tell you and not get myself into trouble for.
Right. You're so diplomatic, so I can feel that happening. Now, we're down to our very last question, and I turned the tables on you, Mike, and I said, if you were conducting this interview, what questions would you have asked, and then what would be your answers?
Oh, okay. I think you asked some pretty tough questions, actually, and I don't know that I necessarily answered them in their entirety, but I guess I would ask, where is the world going? What is the next big thing? And to be honest, I don't know that I do have an answer for that. I think there are a lot of interesting things out there. We're going to a time where there will be an awful lot more automation, where we will have eventually self-driving cars that are practical and used. I remember a NASA patent attorney telling me one time that the most common filing for a patent was a flying car. And people don't realize when they file patents that not only do you have to describe what it is, it has to be something that you describe in such a way that I think the terminology is somebody skilled in the art could replicate it. So it has to have enough detail. So you can't just say, I want to build a flying car. You actually have to give the details as to how you would do it. And I don't think we'll ever have flying cars, but we certainly will have self-driving cars. One of my colleagues uses a brilliant video for an insurance company called Zurich, which has an intersection and all the cars driving past the intersection at top speed, no traffic lights. And I tell him I've actually been on that road in Ethiopia, where a six-lane highway intersected with another six-lane highway, and no circle, no roundabout, no traffic lights, nothing. So I know what it's like. But yeah, I mean, we are going to a point in time where huge amounts will be automated and huge amounts will be online, and it's going to make such a difference to our lives. But it's going to be really interesting to see it, and I hope enough of it happens in my lifetime.
Well, Mike, it's just been such a pleasure talking with you today. I know your schedule is so demanding. In fact, you're almost about to depart now on another venture, another journey. We're indeed fortunate to have you come in to do this interview, and thank you sharing for so much of your experiences and wisdom with our audience.
Well, thank you, Stephen. It's been a pleasure talking to you, as always.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Mike Inchy, globally renowned researcher and incoming IFIP president.